Cluster Conversations, a podcast by Africa Multiple.
Welcome, very warm welcome to our listeners for the latest episode of the Cluster Conversations. My name is Rüdiger Sesemann. I'm the Dean of the Africa Multiple Cluster of Excellence. But today I'm here in my capacity as a scholar of Islamic studies and as the academic host of Dr. Habibat Oladoshu Osman from the University of Ibadan, where she is an associate professor in the Department of Arabic and Islamic Studies. And we are going to have a conversation today about her fellow project and also about some broader aspects of questions pertaining to Islam and gender. I am very honored and pleased to have her here. Dr. Habibat Oladoshu Osman holds a PhD from the prestigious ISTAC, that's the Institute of Islamic Thought and Civilizations at the International Islamic University of Malaysia in Kuala Lumpur. That thesis was on gender politics among Muslims in southwestern Nigeria. And it was eventually published also as a book, if I'm not mistaken. The title of the book is Muslim Women and the Politics of Emplacement, Rereading Space, Sex and Gender, published in 2011 in Berlin by Lampert Publishers. And apart from this book, Dr. Oladoshu Osman is a speaker sought after by many audiences. She has a long record of speaking engagements and conference appearances and also publications, many of them revolving around the question of religion and gender, not just Islam and gender, and some of them also about sort of the hardcore topics of Islamic studies. In her master's thesis, she studied the notion of education in the works of Al-Ghazali, an important medieval scholar of Islam. And while she's done quite a few other things, very impressive CV. I'm, as I said, pleased and honored to be her host here in the Bayreuth Academy of Advanced African Studies. And we want to have a conversation about her fellow project and perhaps also some broader aspects regarding to the study of gender and religion. So welcome to today's podcast, everyone, and a warm welcome to Dr. Oladoshu Osman. Maybe the last thing I should say is the title of her fellow project. It is Gender Politics in the House of God, and it's a comparison between Yoruba religion and Islam, and she will tell us much more about it. So maybe I can start with the question, what do you mean by House of God? Do you conceive of this as a larger concept, or can you tell us more about this notion?
Thank you very much for having me. I am privileged to have you as my host, and I thank you for that. Our listener, gender politics in the House of God. What I meant by House of God is wherever the name of God is mentioned. It now depends on your notion, your conception of God, whether as a supreme being or as a deity or as whatever you conceive of him. So the House of God in this instance is anywhere the name of God is mentioned, the name of God is glorified, whether original or not. It depends on your conception or conception of God. That will be my answer for now, sir.
And I take it that this is a broad concept that can be the house of many different gods. Mm. And I also like this comparative approach that you are taking, and we might elucidate later on your insights from this comparison. But perhaps what I find most intriguing about your study is your empirical research among practitioners of Wodun and Sango. Excuse my probably inaccurate pronunciation of the terms, but can you share some reflections about your empirical findings from the study of these religious rituals and practices, please?
Yeah, thank you. Mentioning the house of God, the other time I said is wherever the name of God is glorified, is mentioned. Now, comparing Islam with traditional religions in West Africa, I particularly singled out Wodun and Sango in West Africa to see how the name of God is being mentioned and how politics of gender is being played out in these houses. Among the Wodun, in fact, let me begin by saying that my motivation to study Wodun developed out of my curiosity while growing up in the streets of Lomé, Togo. As a child, whenever I saw a lady leaving out her breasts, walking on the streets, I became curious. You know, having been taught to be modest as a lady, then I started asking questions. Since then, I've been asking questions. So I, over the time, developed to a kind of inquisitiveness. Then that of Sango too. I was raised among the Yoruba, and I saw how the rituals are being the rituals of, within the Sango courts, how it's being carried out, how the propitations are made, the place of women among the courts. Then I became curious that why is there limitation? Where are there limitations among these religions? How can a woman leave out her breast to satisfy her God? Then how can a woman within the court of Sango be limited to exert her potential just like her male counterparts? And if you look at Islam too, you see that there are many limitations towards women that are not guided by the text, that are not, you know, that cannot be the reason for all this cannot be founded in the text. Then you'll be wondering why the limitations. So when this occasion came to me to apply for this fellowship, and I thought of, yeah, looking at these religions, that is the traditional religions in West Africa and Islam, comparing them, why are there limitations to women's to women's spiritual development? Why are there limitations? So that is why I singled out Wodun and Sango. And if you permit me, Sango was a deity and still a deity. Wodun is a general term for deities and divinities among the Ewe speaker of Togo. So it can come in form of Asango, it can come in form of Ogun, the god of iron, it can come in form of anything. It can come in form of, in fact, it can come in form of god of trees, just divinities. But it is a kind of ancestral belief. Among the Yoruba, we have Egungun. Among the Ewe speakers too, they have Egungun. They call them Wodun too. It depends. They have many types of Wodun. So, but then, within the cosmologies of these deities, you have a male and a female. A male can be a chief priest. A female can also be a chief priest, but with limitations. These are divinities that relate between, these are relationship between the dead and the living. So they believe that there must be mutual connection between the divinities and the adherents, those who worship them, those who sought their help, those who consult them. And in this court, the Sango and Wodun, I mentioned that The Vodun too can come in form of Asango. But within these courts, you find out that men exert their power to any length. But women do have a kind of many limitations. You know, you have to, for your rituals to be acceptable to the deity, for a woman among the Vodou, you have to leave out your breasts, you have to walk in the streets half naked. Among the Sango worshippers, you can wield many influences, but you have limitation of acting like Sango, just like a man can act. A man can impersonate Sango. Sango is no more here. Is in occultation or is hidden, is so that because they didn't believe he died, because they mentioned he entered the heart and he told his adherents to seek his support, his help anytime they need him. So, and I went to the shrine, I saw the rope. They said the rope which he entered the heart. So I saw the remnants of the rope. So that is why I said he said he's in occultation, or maybe he's in hiding. Well, I don't know. It depends on what they want to say about that. But then they go to that shrine to seek the help of Sango. A woman can also go to the shrine to seek the help of Sango and solicit on behalf of the adherent. But then men do impersonate Sango as if Sango is still here by acting exactly like Sango, spitting fire, you know, controlling thunderstorm, and do many things, performing miracles. A woman can only do that if only she agrees to change her identity by becoming a man, by acting like a man, by speaking like a man, by dressing like a man. Why should she change her identity? These are my curiosities.
Mm-hmm. So that's really, really fascinating, and I wish the listeners could see some of the images. Perhaps you have to take a look at the project on the website, which we will hopefully show soon. My larger thoughts pertain now to, as I said earlier, to this comparative dimension, and obviously, there's kind of a contrast between the way women dress in Vodun, as you just illustrated, compared to Islam, which has a rather strict dress code for women who are supposed to hide many parts of their bodies when they go out. But beyond that, can you share your reflections on the comparison between this kind of Yoruba religion and worship on the one hand and Islam on the other? How about the position of women in the houses of the respective gods?
Yeah, thank you very much. So the position of women in the various houses of God has to do with limitations, silencing, muting. In other words, there is a limit to which a woman can go in the various houses of God. Let me start with Islam. Among the Muslims, a Muslim woman cannot, by rule, lead prayers in the mosque when men are there. She can only lead prayers within the corner of women, where women are, where our gender resides. Within the mosque, if there are spaces at all, because among traditional mosques in West Africa, there are no places for women to even worship. So that exclusion alone speaks volumes. Why are there no spaces for women to worship in the house of God? When the Prophet of Islam mentioned that, do not stop the female the female servant of Allah from entering the house of Allah. He mentioned in one of his sayings, why is there, why the exclusion? Why the limitation? Why not? Then among the voodoo and the Sangu worshiper, I mentioned that they have influences. There are propitations and sacrifices that cannot be made without the presence of women. But yet, you feel... In fact, I was told by one of the chief priests in Lomé that, why are you concerned about women's place? A woman worship the Lord of her husband. A woman worship the Lord of her husband. And so, what if the Lord of my husband is not okay with what I stand for, with my worldview? What if the Lord of my husband relegates me to the background? What if the Lord of my husband do not see me as a human being, as a person, as an individual? Why can't I stand up and discover my Lord myself? So that then he said, no, the position of a woman within the court of Vodou, that is lesser than that of a man. They are not the same thing, because man is much more important than a woman. Then when I asked the Sango priest, why should a woman change her identity because she wants to impersonate Sango? She just has to do that because Sango was a man. And then I said, then why are we saying we are equal in the same court? They could not answer why the politics is being played out. They could not answer. That is the way we met our forefathers doing it. In other words, it's just the authority of man that has been put in place over the time that has not been broken by any system, by any culture, by any tradition. It's just there. And I must say that since we are the makers of culture and we are the makers of tradition, we try as much as men, especially, try as much as possible to uphold this so as to establish the authority of men all the time.
So it sounds to me as if God is a patriarch in all these religious traditions. Or why do you think this kind of gender politics plays out in that manner, where women are clearly at a disadvantage? Is it God's fault, or is it the fault of human beings? Is God a patriarch?
Well, I wouldn't say God is a patriarch, because if I say that, and I wouldn't say he's a matriarch, because if I say that, I'm kind of doing anthropomorphism, you know, trying to see God in the image of man. And he isn't like that. Whatever you think of God, he is beyond that. And as a Muslim, he is neither a male nor a female. But within his essence, he is God, and he used the pronoun he for himself just for our understanding. It's just for our understanding. He is not a patriarch because everything he has done in the text, in the scriptures, he has done everything with justice. That is, anything that he does for a female, he does that so that it will satisfy her physiological makeup, not to relegate her. So the what we see in our society is the handwork of man. Zohar al-fasad fil barru wal bar bima kasabati aydin nas. You see corruption on the land, on the oceans, everywhere. Bima kasabati aydin nas, because of what the hands of men have wrought. This has to do with interpretation of the text. It's because men, the majority of men, are the producers of knowledge. They are in charge of everything. So they interpret the text, they interpret everything to suit their purposes. That is what I would say. God is not a patriarch, and it's neither a matriarch.
Mm-hmm. So It seems to me that you hold the position that, at least in Islam, gender roles are complementary. They complement each other. Of course, there's also criticism that women are second-class citizens in Islam. You're aware of that. But you would rather connect this with male interpretation of Islamic religion rather than the way the Islamic way of life is laid out in the Quran and in the practice of the Prophet Muhammad. Is that right?
Yeah, that is exactly what I'm saying. Islam is in no way, it has not placed women as a second class citizen. That is not Islam. Whatever you see now, everywhere you go within the Muslim community, is the handwork of men. It is not Islam, because the Quran states that inna al-muslimina wal-muslimat wal-mu'minina wal-mu'minat wal-qanitina wal-qanitat. You know, Allah stated all this, all the characteristics: the Muslim male, the Muslim female, the believer male, the believer female. Then at the end of that ayah, God now say, "A'adda Allahu lahum maghfiratan wa ajran 'azima." That Allah has promised a great reward for all of this, for all of them, and forgiveness for a female and a male that follows the instructions of Allah. So if Allah has said that, so where is the subordination coming from, if not from the interpreters of the text? So a woman is not subordinate, but then in Islam, there is room for, because if you are in a vehicle now, there must be a driver. There cannot be two drivers in a single vehicle. If there are two drivers, there will be chaos, there will be problem. And that is the recognition of a leader and a follower. And following does not subject a woman to servitude, to subjugation, to a second-class citizen. No, it's just for harmony, complementary. I am a woman, I have my physiology, I possess the womb you do not have. I can carry pregnancy, you cannot carry pregnancy. That is what we meant by complementary roles in Islam. And they are all well defined. And it does not subject a woman to a second class citizen. And the concept of hijab too, dressing, you know, covering up yourself, is to honor women. Because before Islam, women were dressing like animals, so to say, you know, opening their bodies. In the decadent Arab society, the women will come out dancing in nudity in front of nobles of Mecca. That is, you know, but the nobles among the women, among the Arabs then, do dress to cover themselves up. So if Islam says we should dress up, it's about, you know, honor, liberation, you know, bringing equality among the female gender. That is, the freeborn and the slaves should dress as honorable women.
Yeah, so let me come back to your earlier metaphor of one driver and a leader and a follower. You've also expressed some very pronounced criticism of the way Muslim men act as leaders. So isn't it that there seems to be some imperfection in the performance of leadership roles?
Of course, there must be, because they are human, we are human too. There must be imperfections, because some of the time when they want to exert that power of leadership, they become lords. They turn themselves to lords. Sit down there. You don't have voice. You must not say this. You must not go there. You must not leave your house. You must not do this. You must not do that. And that is not how to go about it. It's about consultation. It should be about consultation, because that is what the Quran says. That consult among yourself to arrive at answers. But most of the time, men don't consult.
So it would be upon women in the house of Allah, that is in the house of Islam, to make sure the men abide by this principle of consultation.
Yeah, it's very important because that is where peace lies. That is where Islam is projected as egalitarian way of life.
And do you see a similar constellation in the case of Yoruba religion? Is there also something women could do to improve their position in these communities and rituals?
That is where the problem lies. You know, the most funniest aspect of this thing is that women are now the custodian of this culture. Women are, we are the closest to the children. We are the one teaching them as a woman, as a Yoruba woman, this is how to do, this is how to comport yourself, this is how you can sit. This is, women are the custodian of these problems too. So how do we change it? We change it by continuous advocacy and education and awareness. It's not by fighting. We are not fighting, and we are not agitating for. What we are saying is, let what is right be what is right, and what is wrong remain what is wrong. Let the world know the truth about where our God has placed us. Our God has not placed us as a second-class citizen. Because in the reckoning of the Lord, you are equal. You may not be the same because our physiologies are not the same. You are not the same, but you are equal in terms of spirituality, spiritual development, and in terms of the closeness, the interaction between you and your Lord.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so perhaps we can conclude this podcast with a few reflections on from you about the theoretical implications all this has for the study of gender and religion. Where do you see the most important insights for on the theoretical level?
Yeah, what I see as most important is that over the years, over the time, scholars have not paid attention to intersection between religions in West Africa. They have, some of the time you find them discussing a single religion. Yeah, so scholarly works are no more. They are in reality for like comparative studies like this project is out to do is in reality because. I have many scholars who have discussed about the place of women in Christianity, the place of women in traditional religion in among the Yoruba and in West Africa. The particular one that strikes my attention is that of Oyeronke Oladema, who looked at gender in Yoruba oral tradition, and she sees gender relation within the Yoruba oral tradition as a binary. That is, they are complementary. If we do not see a particular person known as Osugbo, we cannot make sacrifice. In other words, if without the presence of a woman, there can be acceptable sacrifice. But then, if this is the case, where are these limitations coming from? And that is why I see it as very important that this work, this project, is so significant through its comparative studies of what is obtainable among the traditional religion practitioners and what is obtainable among the Muslims, who, by extension, have not, over the years, see reason in appointing a woman as a qadi in a Sharia court or an hisba in West Africa.
Right. So yeah, thank you so much. This is fascinating material and really, really pertinent questions. And I think these questions will remain with us for a long time to come, because wherever you look in religious contexts, I think these questions of gender roles and the participation of women is really pertinent. So thank you so much for sharing your insights with us, and thanks to everyone who listened in. I hope you will remain with Cluster Conversations, and I wish you, Dr. Oladosho Osman, a successful conclusion of your fellow project.
Thank you, thank you, thank you very much.